Debug is brought to you today by Pixelmator for iPad, a powerful, full-featured, layer-based image editor that gives you everything you need to create, edit, and enhance images on your iPad. It's packed with powerful creative tools. There's true-to-life painting, powered by an impressive painting engine, incredible color adjustment, retouching tools, gorgeous effects, shapes, typography, features, selection tools, non-destructive layer styles, and pretty much all the advanced imaging tools you could imagine. Designed from the ground up specifically for the iPad and iOS 8, it's compatible with all popular file formats, and it works on the iPad 2 and later iPads, including the iPad mini. To find out more about Pixelmator for iPad, go to pixelmator.com/blog.
What are we talking about here, guys?
Yeah, I don't know. We're whatever.
It's gonna be like a Don Melton cast. We're just we're all over the place. RoboCop and Blade Runner.
So your reviews out? How'd it go?
Yeah, it went all right.
Yeah, you happy with it? I know you talked to you know, people should go listen to what's it called, the talk show at ATP, because you pretty much covered it, right?
Yeah, I mean, like I'm not unhappy. I don't know. I'm happy with parts. I'm unhappy with parts. Mostly just glad to be done.
It's like when you
I am my own best critic. I will not say I'm my own worst critic, because I'm not. I think I'm my own best critic, in that I think I know what's really wrong with it.
Yeah.
In my heart of hearts.
Yeah. But you know, you got to ship at some point. Did you? Actually, I don't know if I asked you to this. Did you pull a button on the day or a couple of days before to get the EPUB stuff prepped?
Continuous integration. Like, so I think several weeks before I had something publishable, because we didn't have a release date for such a long time. And then once I have something publishable, that means all three versions are, I've got the Kindle version, I've got the EPUB version, I've got the RCMS version, all three ready to go. And then from that point on, I basically just constantly added things, did corrections, downloaded new GM builds, retested things. Yeah. During that whole time, I'm rebuilding all the versions. I'm re-uploading versions to the various ebook stores so that, you know, eventually I got a release date and then you could actually time it all together. But
praying that the screenshots don't change.
Yeah, and just trying to test things at the last minute. And like that's the worst part about this. Trying to be there as soon as like the bits go up on the Mac App Store, it's impossible to get a lot of things right. You know, I wish I had a team of people testing the installer on all different machines to figure out how everything works and checking that the defaults are what I think there are. You know, it's just the amount of time it takes basically to install an OS. There's no getting around that. And if I'm doing it sort of in my spare time after I come home from work, then only so many hours in the day I can get it done. That's my biggest regret with all these most recent ones, is that everything's been so tight. There's so little slack. It used to be like you'd have the GM build and it could be weeks before it came out. And that was just luxurious, where you could just spend time getting everything right. And now it's just a race to the finish. So,
yeah, it seems like they would, you know, embargo release date for people that they've given review stuff to, right? Because I know like they helped people this year because they needed for the handoff stuff, right?
Well, they do that. It's just not a very long lead time. I mean, the last GM was very shortly before, you know, how long was it before the actual release? I don't think it was like maybe less than a week.
Yeah, it was the Thursday and then the Thursday again.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but they won't tell you.
And it was still a different build number.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. So, like, it was basically the same one, you know, whatever it was, 88A and 88B, and then the App Store one was 89, but still.
Did you hard sync of that?
No, I mean, you got it close enough, right? And then the thing is, like, the way it installs is different too. You get like, you know, you download a different installer. So, because the installers are not, I guess the build number is associated with the installer, but anyway, it's such a hassle. I try not to think about it. I hate it when they go up and there are things in it that are wrong and I got to scramble to fix it and blah, blah, blah.
Right. So are you going to go to WWDC this year?
I don't know.
You know, really, like that, maybe you can go and not write the review.
Yeah, that would. I think about that a lot. I'm like, boy, wouldn't that be nice just to go and just like enjoy yourself? But without a real reason to go, there's also no reason for me to get any special treatment from Apple for getting tickets. And then I'm just in the lottery with the rest of the people. And now it's like, and then it would also mean it's really expensive and I would get no money. I wouldn't get any money back from that, you know?
I don't know. You could still get Apple love. I mean, you could vote smaller pieces, right?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
like you're Swift. portion of the review or any given portion of this review, it's valuable, right?
That's part of the plan, is like, I think that the time of something, a big review like this may be passing, or at least for me doing them anyway. But presumably, if I don't have this, I will have other avenues where I can, especially with there being with the public betas and everything, it's like you can actually write things legitimately before the thing is released in small doses. And maybe I'll do that, you know. So, yeah. I mean, that's what I tell myself. But like, Twitter really does suck a lot of the creative juices out of me. So I don't know how much is left for my neglected blog. But, you know, the reason I made that blog and the reason it's important for me to have that blog is it's a place where if I have a thought, I can write it up after coming home from work, write it up, get it published and be done with it. Like, I know exactly where it's going to go and I control everything and, you know.
Right. So you'd write under the Hypercritical banner rather than Ars Technica?
Well, I mean, if I actually wanted someone to read it, I might do it for Ars, but that's the whole, you know, then you have to basically like pitch that you want to do the story and deal with, you know, it's not that much of a hassle, but it's way more of a hassle to just throw it up on my blog. But nobody reads my blog. So it depends, like, do you actually want a lot of people to read this? And at this point, I don't really care one or the other. Yeah. So if I just put it on my blog and the 10 people who read my blog read it, that's fine.
Well, it is chicken and egg stuff too, right?
Nobody reads my blog because nothing is posted to it. So it's a straightforward connection between why no one reads.
So everybody go to hypercritical.org. Is that it?
No, it's not.
CO.
Yeah. Is it CO? Okay. Yeah, well, everybody go to hypercritical.co.
It's like at least one post a year that happens.
Yeah. Well, no, we're just going to get you. We'll get you a server spike.
No. I mean, there's no return. There's no ads on the site. There's no, I don't get anything for the hits.
Yeah. No, that's pointless.
Exactly.
So, do you have a favorite section? Like, I know what I want to talk to. Like, we got to get back to talking about Swift, and then maybe you can beat me up about some 20-year-old garbage. But is there anything that, like, kind of stood out to you that you wanted to discuss?
With all things, I have to pick what I'm going to concentrate on in the review. And this one was easier just because there's, you know, the new UI is such a heavy emphasis in the OS and from Apple about that. And then continuity is the other big pillar. And then there's some other miscellaneous stuff like, you know, CloudKit and extensions and the iCloud stuff and stuff like that. And then Swift was the other big tent pole that I picked just because I'm writing a review, I get to pick what I write about. Yeah. And honestly, because I think it's an important, you know, it's an important story in the Apple platform. And I'm going to write a view of OS X, like the Swift part of OS X. Not really, but kind of. But it's, you know, I'm going to write about it. So anyway, there's always something like that I pull out. And so this time it was Swift. I mean, I guess GCD maybe had more of a foundation in that. But like the Snow Leopard review was all about all the various technologies they had for you to take advantage of multi-core and stuff. And it was, so that was a natural fit. But I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
So, first of all, thank you for clearing up the window background thing.
I still get people tweeting at me and saying that I'm wrong. So
I know.
I said, no, don't you, like, I don't know how many times I can explain it, but it, like, I thought I had explained it in a reasonable way with an experiment that you can do by taking like a white window and putting it behind a vibrant thing. And then, you know, but that experiment is not convincing to people. So anyway, whatever.
It was confusing.
It was confusing to me in many of the builds as well. So I don't blame you for getting it slightly wrong, and I don't blame people for still not understanding it, because it's really subtle, and depending on what is contributing, it can be completely invisible, right?
Right.
But the one thing that is absolutely visible is like they can wave a window around and say, see, I can see the stuff behind it. I put it over this black splotch. I put it over this white splotch. It's totally showing me what's behind it, and it is. It is showing you what's behind it, but it's also tinging it with your desktop background, which may or may not be visible depending on what your desktop background is and what you're putting it over.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about your case of, which is probably the common case. It's like you have your kids on the desktop. Like I typically just go with like a green background of some kind, not static green, but I think I've got fields right now. So I have a very, you know.
So everything has like a pale, sickly green.
Exactly. Yeah, but I mean, it's because it's, I also clutter my desktop. So I've got a noisy picture, it makes it hard to see the icons, right? So if you've got a photo of your kids and you like looking at your kids, but you pick up some weird vibrancy color thing. That's got to be super annoying.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's a picture of my one at work is a picture of my son, but it's also it's a pumpkin patch. So it's all orange. And the way vibrancy picks up that orange, like I don't want sort of pale, dirty creamsicle orange menu bar and menus. Yeah. Right. And I could just chop out the top of the image and put a white stripe up there to try to, you know, trick the menu bar. But then the sidebar in my applications has that color. And I just don't want it there. At home, what I'm looking at now, I have a picture that happens to have blue sky at the top edge. So my menu bar is relatively white and relatively opaque. But the other backgrounds are kind of tannish brown. I don't know. Various people have been telling me, and I'm sure this is the case, that you can turn that off in the sidebars with a, you know, probably some property that you can set, but by default it's on. And so applications that were made before Yosemite existed, of course they just get the default. So that's why, you know, it's showing through in Outlook. Although from the screenshots I saw the new version of Outlook, it's also showing through in the new version. So much.
How ugly did that look?
Yeah, Outlook has never been a looker.
That's true.
I got to use it for work. I tolerate it.
Yeah, that is true. But it's like a big green sidebar. I don't understand the logic.
So many buttons.
Yeah. Not that I want to rant about this all the whole time.
I would care less about how Outlook looked if it actually worked right, but it doesn't.
Right. That's a bummer.
This is the most frustrating thing ever. Like, we're using Exchange Server at work, and like the supposed function of Exchange Server is so people can set up meetings and put things on people's calendars, and it just doesn't work. Like, I accept things, and they sort of, you know, become opaque on my calendar, and then the next day they look like I haven't accepted them again. I have to re-accept them. An update to an invitation comes along. You can't accept this until you accepted the previous invitation. I totally did that yesterday. It doesn't remember. It doesn't care. Years this has been going on. It's incredibly frustrating.
That's annoying. And this is in Outlook.
Yes, this is a complete Microsoft stack. I'm using Microsoft Office latest version with like the latest version of Microsoft Server. And like if you have a Mac, it just doesn't work right.
Yeah, that stinks. Ah, well, stupid Microsoft. No, I just want to rant about Microsoft the whole time. So were there any other big interface changes? I liked the Spotlight change. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's interesting to see like Apple kind of catching up to where third parties have been for so long. Like they were always just up there in the corner doing their thing and everybody was downloading like, you know, first Quicksilver and then or Launch Bar and Alfred and all these very popular third-party utilities. And Apple's just stuck up in the corner with its weird blue thing, not doing what everybody else is doing. And it was just right there in front of them to do all the stuff. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, we put it front and center. We can do unit conversions. We can do Google lookups. We can like, it's like all the stuff everyone else was doing. And they did a reasonable job of it. So
yeah, I thought so. It's pretty handy. It should be responsive too. So that's good. It's come a long way. Cause when it came out, I think you're probably the guy to know. What was it? 10.4?
Yeah. 10.4, I think.
Yeah.
Codename Matador.
That's good to see. You're the trivia guy.
What the heck was the code name? Tiger was coded it.
No, Spotlight was Matador.
Oh, all right. I was like, that's not a wine name or a cat name.
No.
Yeah.
It's just so random.
Yeah. I was going to say I know the name of the next OS X release, but who cares? Well, it's pointless and it's just,
Spinal
I don't know.
Final
Tap,
know,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know where I heard it from and I probably shouldn't say it. So dark mode. Seems crazy to me. I don't know how you feel about it.
I don't like, first of all, it's such a little toe dip. It's like, it's not dark mode. It's
right.
We can make some things dark, probably with minimal impact of third parties, except for all the menu extras that'll draw incorrectly, but they'll probably fix that by release, right guys? Right. and it kind of worked out. Changing the color, like letting people change the color of anything is weird. Like we always had, you know, graphite and you know, blue, which was rainbow colored or whatever, but then other than that it was, you know, customization, no, that's not a thing you can do. Like we can Apple changes what the UI looks like from release to release, but you don't change it, you don't get to pick. And now all of a sudden you have this one choice. And you know, when I asked Apple about it, they said the thing about it matching pro applications. So you don't have like a super dark, I guess, Final Cut Pro or Logic or whatever. And then you have this white menu bar blaring in your face from the control booth of your studio or whatever. It makes some vague sense in that respect. But once you start down that road of letting people do that, I mean, you're either going to go full appearance manager where you're drawing everything with like brushes or whatever the hell they were, or you're never doing any. you're never doing anything with a Ennis white color or whatever. Like, it's all themes, you know, but that's just not the way Cocoa is designed. So they're far from that. But if you don't do that, everything is like, you're just multiplying the QA burden of like, is this visible in dark mode? You know, is this visible retina, non-retina, dark mode? And I guess all the accessibility things, but I think there's less of a QA burden on those because they assume fewer people will use them. But dark mode, you know, that's right there. It's a checkbox anyone can find.
Yeah, that was my take on it too. Is it just, I don't think the value is there for the amount of energy and effort put into it. Because, I mean, most of the previews, it was just flat out broken.
And it's so minor. Like, I mean, they changed their own stuff. So they changed Spotlight, fine, or whatever. Yeah. But it's like, it really just a menu bar and dock. And you know, one of those, the dock is the only one that's pretty much safe because like they control that. It's never allowed any third party stuff ever since the menu docklet, whatever those things were, are gone. Menu bar, yeah, other people have icons up there, and that was like, oh well, half of our third party stuff doesn't draw right, and you better hope that your developers that these apps are still supported. Like if you have one that hasn't been updated in 3 years and it draws black on black in dark mode, well, you're SOL.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't understand it. I was talking to Ryan Nielsen, who, just for the listeners, he used to be a project manager on OS X. He's not at Apple anymore. He was kind of befuddled that they put this in, because all it does is just increase work on all of the teams to try to get it right or try to support it. And it seems to me that it's just spinning for no real value.
And so, like, who's the constituency there? Like, that's, you
exactly,
know,
yeah.
Like the constituency, I suppose, could be those pro people who are just sick of a stark white menu bar gleaming in their face from the top of their otherwise dark interface. But since when does Apple care so much about pro anything that they're going to change their OS on the behalf of them?
Well, and the other thing is, sorry, I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
I was going to say the other possible constituency is some group or person or whatever inside Apple that has a bee in their bonnet about customization.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably it. But because to address the pro apps thing, I don't know why you'd need this to be a system wide preference, right? Like if you
why didn't it just
click into Logic Pro,
yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, so
yeah, and if there is a constituency inside Apple of people who want this, I don't know who those people are or what their motivations are.
No, and I'm pretty sure the pro apps group doesn't have the weight to throw around to get.
Yeah, the group and the customers don't. So it's just like Phil Schiller wakes up someday and says, you know what would look cool? Black menu bar. I read it on that Nevin Mergen site.
Maybe it was Johnny.
It's fun to see like black things.
I don't know, but maybe he runs a pro app of some sort.
He's Mr. White. As Marco has said, he lives in his white world.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
He's like the opposite of a black hole. He just, everything around, the color is pulled out of it.
Yeah, I like the notion of him just floating in his perfect white sphere. So yeah, mixed feelings about the UI update, but it's nothing insulting. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like the minor issues of like the vibrancy stuff that I can kind of control by changing my desktop background and stuff like that. That is really my only major complaint. Everything else about the look, even on non-retina where I'm using it, because now all my retina Macs are gone. Even on non-retina, even though it looks worse than it does on retina, it is a refreshing change from the previous looks. I like the buttons. I like the dock. Scroll bars really aren't that different. I even like the combined title bar, toolbar for the most part, despite the obvious usability problems here and there. I even don't mind the crazy rainbow colors going up behind toolbars because, again, the buttons on the toolbars are still opaque. So, I can see this look dating pretty quickly. It's not as timeless as, say, you know, System 7, right?
But of course you go there.
Well, System 7 are pretty darn timeless. And in some respects, you could say, like, the original Aqua look, even though we cringe at it now, that had a pretty long lifetime. But this whole crazy rainbow color thing, I can imagine us looking back on this and thinking, oh, how did we ever look at that? But because it's not a timeless overall look, I think the button designs are very clean and crisp, but all the rainbow colory stuff is going to be like, oh, that was silly when we did all the rainbow stuff. But it's a refreshing change of pace for now, which is exactly what you need out of like a fashion type update where like sometimes you just need something new to look at every day.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't need to be timeless because next year they're going to be updated, right? So
yeah, like this, you know, as I think I said, it was on a talk show or whatever. Like, it took a long time to go from the original Akko, which is exuberant and iconic and crazy, to slowly file off all the edges to settle down into essentially the leopard look. That's five versions, right? Okay. So 10.15, assuming they don't jump to 11 or whatever, or change the name sometime before that, 10.15 should be this look distilled to the essence of what's good about it with all of the bad stuff removed, we hope, if they follow the same trajectory. Or they could just, you know, every other year just go hog wild and flip it all over, because it may end up following like the iOS type pattern where, you know, iOS went to this revolution in 7, and presumably it'll be refined for 8, 9, whatever. But at some point, like, this isn't, there could be another iOS 7 like transition, the 6 to 7 type transition. Yeah. I don't know how long off that is, but if that happens, you have to think the Mac is going to follow suit, or in the current regime, probably do it at the same time.
Yeah. The design's going to be informed by it for sure. I would guess that they would have to change iOS for 10, just even if it's just arbitrarily. You know what I mean? Like,
I'll bring back the shadows.
I don't know. I mean, the marketing department could rejigger all this naming anytime it wants to. Like, the names are just names. So people always ask that, like, when are they going to change this Google one? I was like, whenever marketing decides to. Like, that is not an engineering decision for the most part. The engineering decision was already made when they based iOS off of OS 10. Like, they're all on Darwin. It's all, you know, I guess the closest engineering decision you could get is how much of UIKit leaks into OS 10. And you can see some of that with, like, the weird UIKit, you know, allow this thing to use your location in the notification center sidebar. It's like, how the hell does iOS UI get onto my Mac? Well, there's some shared code there, I'm sure, but UIKit is still very distinct from AppKit, and that type of merging is the only thing the engineering has any control over. But the naming, you know, if they just decided some arbitrary point to rename these things in a more sensible, although given recent naming trends at Apple, I think we should not be holding our breath for a more sensible, coherent naming scheme.
Yeah, that was a bit of a misstep. And just to reiterate, the engineers actually don't know the names of this stuff until, like, right before it's shipped, and there's a commit from, like, their top-level manager that just sticks a name in it.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, but for the engineering decision, it's like, you know, how much UIKit-type models leak into AppKit, and how much, you know, like, how much do they get closer together? Because UIKit is sort of like a newer take on how to do a UI with Objective-C. And then maybe we're waiting for an even newer take of how to do a UI in Swift a couple of years from now, right?
I think we're going to need to see that, yeah. So I don't know if they'll start with Swift at the low end, meaning foundation style stuff, or at the high end, meaning, UI.
Yeah, I mean, well, what they're going to start with is, you know, using it as an Objective-C replacement where you're just calling through to Objective-C frameworks, and they use it to work out all the kinks of how do you call into these APIs with these conventions and all that. Like, that's what they're doing now. That's the easiest and most straightforward way to dog food is whatever the first major Swift app will be, it's simply going to be you're using all the existing frameworks. Your app's custom code may be written in Swift, but you got to call into whatever your framework is. And it's all about glue code and making the glue code efficient. And that's what we want out of dogfooding this one anyway. Show me you can make an app with the existing frameworks with this new language.
Right. So I totally agree. I think we're not going to see the power of Swift, I guess, until Apple starts shipping Swift frameworks, we won't know what the sort of the correct Swift idiomatic way of doing frameworks is, right?
Yeah, and I don't even know, like, that's a good question of whether they will start by, like, picking an unloved C++ API. Feel free to insert your favorite one here. and Swiftifying that, or go the other route and pick some high-level type thing. Like, say you're making a new high-level framework for an as-yet-unannounced feature. Right. And instead of coming with Objective-C API, this one comes with a Swift API.
Yeah. My guess would be they'll start on the low end, if only because they could share it between iOS and OS 10.
That seems reasonable, except for like things like maybe address book or like keychain or something. Like the reason things get done in a low level language is because they need to be, like core audio, right? And so you can't tell like the AV Foundation people, we'd really like you to do this as a new API in Swift. And you're like, that's great and all, but I don't really want to debug your performance problems right now. Like we know how C and C++ work, and it's kind of a non-starter for performance critical code. So it seems more likely to me that, like, I don't know, pick a new framework that came out in the recent WWDC, like, you know, so maybe like continuity or something. Sometimes it's a UI type networking feature. It doesn't exist now. You're not rewriting anything. Write that from scratch in Swift. You'll figure out some interesting things, and you don't have to convince anybody to convert some working code into a new language for, you know, no reason.
Right.
We take a quick break so I can tell you about Mandrill from our friends at MailChimp. Mandrill is a scalable, reliable, and secure email infrastructure service trusted by more than 300,000 customers. It's easy to set up and integrate with existing apps, and it's really, really fast. With servers all over the world, Mandrill can deliver your email in milliseconds. There's detailed delivery reports, advanced analytics, and a friendly interface, and that means your entire team, from developers to marketers, can easily monitor and evaluate email performance. And they've got a special offer just for Debug listeners. You can sign up at mandrill.com with promo code debug, and you'll receive 50,000 free email sends per month for your first 6 months of service. So what is an email infrastructure service? Well, it's an idea that started in 2010, became a reality in 2012 when Mandrill cannibalized a crew of MailChimp's best engineers, isolated from the rest of the team. They turned the idea from a skunkworks project into a product that outperforms competitor services. It's growing fast. It's innovating faster. You can use Mandrill to send automated one-time emails like password resets and welcome messages, as well as marketing emails and customized newsletters. It's really quick to set up. It's easy to use. It's ridiculously stable. And they made it for developers who love documentation, integrations, high delivery rates, webhooks, and analytics. If you're not comfortable with code and APIs, they recommend finding someone who is before you get started, because this is serious mail for serious people. So once again, go to mandrill.com and use promo code debug, and you'll receive 50,000 free email sends per month for the first 6 months of your service. Thanks, Mandrill.
So all in all, what do you think about Swift? We had dinner the day it was announced, and I think we agree and disagree on with similar aspects of the language, right?
Yeah, like it's weird. When we had that dinner, I didn't understand as much about the language, about the motivations of the language as I do now. So in many respects, I can kind of like, I understand where it's coming from. And I admire its ambition, but it's, and the thing is, like, I recognize a lot of its influences, but it's weird that a lot of its influences, like, find themselves dressed up in, like, a different, you know, like, it's so weird in how it wants to look, either on casual inspection and to the programmer. It's so different than what it actually is under the covers, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it borrows so much from, you know, languages like Ruby and yes, even Perl and things like that. While borrowing none of the underlying semantics and implementation, like where languages where everything is super dynamic all the time. And it's like, this looks like that, but this is a language where everything is nailed down as much as possible at compile time, because that's the way they want to do this language, because it has to, you know, scale down to the low end as well. And so, with all the weird, like hanging off the end, it's this giant appendage of like, oh yeah, and the Objective-C runtime is in the mix too, because we have to. So if you want that, you can have it, but it's like, these feel like left to their own brothers. They would be like, you know, I don't like that. I don't like not knowing which method is going to be called. The optimizer can't see through that boundary. It is completely opaque. We need that not to happen. We need that not to be, that decision not to be made at runtime.
Right.
But that, you know, they have to hook into like the, it's like, I'm not going to say it's a language that has a disdain for the Objective-C runtime, but it's clear that if that was an important feature, Swift would work like that too. Like it would have the Swift runtime that would work like the Objective-C runtime, but more efficient. And the Swift runtime is, we'll figure it out at compile time for you.
Right. That would, we should point out that they do bridge relatively seamlessly.
Do you want to call it
a bridge? It's a bridge, I guess,
well,
kind of.
I would call it a series of idioms mapping from one to the other, because like Objective-C APIs, they work a certain way, not because of language constraints. It's like idiomatically, like this is the way we do things. And this happens so often that we can come up with a construct and put it in the damn language and say, oh, when you do this, this maps to that, maps, you know, it's in the mission state for the language. It's like, you have to do this. Otherwise the language is a non-starter. You must make it both possible and reasonably pleasant to use the bazillions of existing APIs that we have. In all sorts of languages, and one of the major ones is Objective-C. So they just have to do that. Then you have to be able to, you know, base your classes on NSObject. You just, you know, you just have to do it, right? But like, if the language is designed in isolation, Apple is not a company, someone's just saying, I think I'll think up a language. This would definitely be a weird language. Like,
oh yeah,
if you take away the context, it is strangely shaped.
Yeah, That's a good way of putting it. That's what I was getting back, just getting back to the Swift framework thing before. Objective-C is, so I like it. I enjoy working in a lot, but I don't, the language is one thing, but it's the idiomatic stuff that's built atop of it that actually makes it worthwhile. Because you can do crazy stuff in Objective-C, like really horrible stuff. But just the approach that's growing up around Cocoa and AppKit and Foundation and UIKit over the years makes Objective-C a relatively sane language. I don't know yet of the idiomatic Swift approach to stuff. So I think that's going to be interesting to...
Well, like, you know how kind of like blocks, when they're introduced, mm-hmm. were pretty readily adopted by both the people inside Apple who make Objective-C frameworks and also by programmers, because there's a whole new class of things that were just very inconvenient to do before that suddenly become much nicer to do with blocks. And it's kind of a Cambrian explosion where it's like, every API's got to add blocks. Do this with block, do that with block. And like, it's not the same as callback hell in terms of the enthusiasm with which people first have for a thing until they get neck deep in code that is all filled with that. Like, callbacks are worse. But blocks is like, if you just do everything with the blocks, like at a certain point, you're like, wait a second, why am I doing this block? Just because I think it's cool. Like, it makes a whole class of things easier, but then you just start to use them everywhere and it gets out of control. And so...
Yeah.
But anyway, that idiom was adopted rapidly. It wasn't possible in Objective-C before because blocks didn't exist, and suddenly it was. And it's like, oh, this is a new thing. This is great. Well, there's 50 of those things in Swift, and all of them are going to be overused. And until we figure out what the right way to use them is, and you know how to sort of hold back. I mean, like blocks now, I think have matured to the point where you know they're an integral part of Swift, and you know the syntax for them, and it's much nicer, and you know like. That I hopefully is reaping all the years we've done with GCD style blocks. And by the way, the concurrency library, like there's no concurrency or anything in Swift. GCD is the, you know, if you want to use that for concurrency, you can, it's there. Mm-hmm. But Swift is so young that basically everything that's missing from the language, you're like, well, that doesn't mean anything because nothing is in the friggin' language. It's all in the standard library. So if the next release comes out and it has exceptions and regular expressions, and concurrency, it'll all just be library things and we'll roll with it.
Yeah, I am kind of surprised that GCD wasn't. I could see GCD fitting under Swift as almost like a runtime level feature, right? Like Swift just assumes that GCD is there, and so it has effectively syntax sugar.
But nothing precludes that. Like everything that's I mentioned, you know, exceptions are a great example. Why does Swift not have exceptions? Are they philosophically against exceptions? Maybe, but. Maybe not, like, you know, or regular expressions. Why string manipulations? Why don't we have regular expression built into the language? Like, it's just there waiting for someone to, like, the language is made in such a way that none of these features, you don't feel like that's always going to feel awkward because it's not going to be part of the language. It will feel 100% natural if and when it appears. And in the meantime, feel free to write your own regular expression library, which people did within, like, days of Swift coming out, right?
Right.
You know. Hook it up to PCRE and muddle your way through. But I fully expect over the many years, Apple to slowly but surely add, you know, to the language, quote unquote, really just to the standard library, even, you know, to other libraries, all these features that Swift doesn't have now.
So how would you describe, or at least let's try to describe for the listeners, what Swift, the actual language is? Because it's incredibly small.
Yeah, I forget what I put in the review, but it's like the keywords, control flow, and like functions, function signatures, and that type of syntax, and of course the you know, and the existence of operator overloading and all you know like the mm-hmm. the core line. There's not much to the core language. Everything that you would think of as being part of the language, anything to do anything useful, like just numbers and string types, you know, standard library.
Yeah,
right?
I mean addition.
Yeah,
of course, because the numbers are the thing. But you name it, it's in the standard library rather than being in the.
Yeah,
I'll call it the kernel. I don't know what you'd call it.
Well, I mean, it's not like for example, kernel. Like I know a lot of languages even define their control flow, like the if and else and while. They define that in terms of closures, and so like there's nothing to the language. It's like, you know, everything is. You're gonna go full Lisp where there's no syntax, right? But even like Perl 6 and stuff does its control structures, you know, quote unquote in the language, but. The Swift standard library is, you know, it's like, oh, it's, you know, the core language is small and everything's in the library, but the Swift standard library is different. It has to be different. Otherwise, nothing would work. Everything would be ridiculously slow. And so the Swift standard library has a privileged position where it bolts onto this built-in library and it gets screwed down into the LLVM IR, which eventually gets screwed down into your actual CPU that you're running on. It has to do that, otherwise it can't fulfill its mission to be a language that scales down to low-level stuff. So it's a super clever solution where from the outset it looks like nothing is in the language, everything is defined in the library. It's like, yeah, but you know, every library is equal, but some are a little bit more equal than others. And so,
yeah, exactly.
And because they controlled the whole stack, they can do this in a way that it's not, I'm not going to say it is transparent, no pun on the attribute, but like, if you don't know or care about the implementation, it just seems like this magical language that happens to be fast, but looks like everything is user defined. But somewhere, you know, you have to, somewhere the rubber has to meet the road, and they control the whole stack and all the things in between and can even add layers in between. And if you just design the language, like here is a syntax spec and a semantic spec. Now someone please write a compiler for this language. You can't do that. Like, right. it would not come out as nicely, because unless you have a concrete plan on how you type this and then I will make it run fast, unless you have a concrete plan for that, it's not easy. Like, and sometimes it's not possible at all. So
no, you need to understand the problem from top to bottom, basically.
And you have to know that it's possible. You have to know that it's possible with your compiler that you're going to, you know, hook up to it. You have to know, like, you have to sort of, you have to match up all the little wires between, like, okay, this built-in goes to this LLVM, you know, IR, what do they call it, intrinsic, that goes to this instruction on this CPU. Like, you have to go all the way down and all up and all the way down. You can't just pick the language and go, it would be cool if you had a language that acted like this. Now, please make that fast for me.
Yeah, well, you can have one or the other, right? Unless you do it this way. So you skipped, or at least omitted, a layer in there, which is the SIL.
Yeah, no, you can, as I mentioned, like, if you control the whole stack, you can actually add layers. Like, right. You said, it's inconvenient for us to go from the AST all the way down to LLVM IR, because there's all sorts of structures in this high-level language that if we immediately turn them into LLVM IR, we lose information that would be useful for figuring out how to optimize this.
Right. So you could fit into this Swift intermediate language is what I assume it stands for.
Yeah, and you don't have to do that, because C++ goes right down to LLVM, I believe. Like, yep. You don't have to have an intermediate language. C++ has certainly lots of rich semantics, but it's harder to do that way. I'm sure they learned from their experience of implementing the C++ 11 spec or whatever the last one they're trying to do. And this intermediary language, I think, is just, you know, it's a straightforward layered approach of, like, make each transition point do a well-defined job, and SIL is... You know, it looks more like LLVM IR, but if you squint, the structure looks more like the Swift, and so you're retaining more information about it.
So do you see the utility of SIL being beyond just this extra staging compilation to maintain some context? Or, I mean, one of the things I was thinking of is you could swap out the syntax of Swift and have something else create SIL, right?
Nah, I mean, SIL looks so much like Swift that I think the two are close enough together. Like, right now it looks like something that aids the implementation, like that you have another optimization target that you can optimize at this level and do high level optimizations, and then, you know, go down to LLVM IR and do lower level optimizations, and then finally, you know, generate your machine code. Yeah. That it's just a better straightforward layered approach to doing things, but it is a significant. Burden to say, like, we're going to make the whole other language with a whole other thing that now, you know, this gets changed into that, that gets changed. It is a, you know, adding the extra step in the process, another place where things can go wrong, another place for bugs to appear because, you know, that you haven't, this SIL isn't exactly what you meant in Swift. Like, it is an added complication, but long term, I think they're betting it's going to be a win. I don't know what other, it does seem like a big thing, and I don't know what other purpose they might have in mind for it. I mentioned that in their review, just because, you know,
it seems like a lot of work but
I mean, it could just be good long-term thinking. Like, yeah. This is going to seem like a lot of work, guys. We got to make a whole other parser and lexer and a whole other, basically, you know, thing to figure out this language and compile into the next form and have the optimizer work with this into the other thing. But trust me, long-term, it'll be better. It'll keep us sane. Yeah. And probably because they knew they were going to be changing the syntax of the Swift part a lot. And
yeah,
so
break it out to them.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And, you know, this way it does mean that they can swap out both the syntax side and the compiler side if they ever want to. It's Chris Latin's compiler, so I don't know why he'd want to, but it does make sense that you'd you know, this seems like a good logical breakpoint, right?
Yeah, and every time I look at Swift, though, like I always have these strange delusions of like it being a replacement for JavaScript in an upcoming version of Safari. Like, obviously, talk to Google how well that works out with the Dart stuff. And like, that's not a technical problem. That's like a social problem of like, you can make a better language. It doesn't matter if it's not everybody's web browser. But like, that's the reason I linked to the fourth tier LVM, you know, optimizer thing. Because like, you just think about those poor guys working on the JavaScript stuff, and it's like. Like they don't like the whole like they don't want to make their own. The whole reason they're using LLVM for this thing is that just they spent all these years making JavaScript fast, writing their own optimizers, and they're all like, we have a whole team doing it. Like, why? It's not resource sharing. You would like the team that's doing all the compiler optimization stuff to be able to benefit everybody who does that type of stuff. Whereas the WebKit team's over there saying, well, we've got our own version of a lot of the same things you have in LLVM, but ours need to be different because we have a different environment. Or, you know, compile time is important to us, blah, blah. So they found a place where they could actually use LLVM. Maybe those two ships will never cross unless they start shipping bytecode out over the web to people. But I don't know. I really hate JavaScript. I use it all the time and at work. And
yeah,
I have delusions of grandeur about someday someone replacing it with something better.
That'd be nice, but I mean, it's popular by accident, right? And that's always the hardest kind of things to displace.
Yeah, I don't know how you get rid of it, but you know, there may be a point where it's like, we can't make this any faster. Just the way the language works.
Those guys have been doing amazing work, though. Like that, they shouldn't have to, but that four-tiered of optimization stuff is pretty fancy.
Yeah, and I mean, even like, you know, giving up parts of the language, like if you use the closure compiler, there's like an advanced optimization mode that only works, like that only basically is correct if your JavaScript conforms to certain requirements. Like, you can't use certain constructs because they'll make your code invalid and it won't run anymore. But it's like, if your code looks like this and you just use these features in this way, our advanced closure compiler can optimize it for you. This is a thing that just rewrites the source, you know, like a minifier thing.
Does it tell you before it outputs something that's just going to eat itself alive?
I think so. We can't use it at work because our JavaScript code is non-compliant. That's as far as we got.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have to sort of know ahead of time, but like, that's Google saying, look, half of our applications are JavaScript. We would like to make it faster. We'd like for you to use Dart, but if that's not going to happen, if you use a closure compiler, there's a simple optimization mode, which doesn't do much of anything. It just screws with local variables and stuff. Yeah. And then there's the more advanced one that digs through function call boundaries and can inline stuff and stuff like that. But like, JavaScript just doesn't have enough. JavaScript is too dynamic for you to do many of those optimizations, just like Objective-C. You can't know, looking at the source code, what's going to be where and what's safe to inline and what's safe. It's just not, you know. So we're reaching the limits of how much faster you can make JavaScript. It's like, what? It's going to return to a hardware discussion, but like,
that's fine.
At some point, Moore's law stops, right? Because you know, subatomic particles only get certain. You can't keep slicing. You can't keep making feature sizes smaller forever because subatomic particles are a thing, and not going to have like gluons, individual gluons making garbage chip or whatever those. So at some point, Moore's law ends, and whenever that happens, if anything is not fast enough, we either need another breakthrough, you know, quantum computing, optical computing, or whatever. And in lieu of that, there may be a period of time where it's like, if JavaScript's still not fast enough, there may finally be motivation, and we'll all be dead. But anyway, there may be finally be motivation and will to like replace JavaScript with something faster in browsers. But I don't know.
So Copeland 2050 JavaScript problem?
I don't know. When is Moore's law supposed to end? I guess you could just keep it dividing the feature sizes until you get smaller than an atom.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But it'll be long enough.
Yeah, we'll be gone.
Yeah. So I don't think either of us got what we expected with Swift.
I gotta think more than I expected, because what I expected is what everyone says they wanted, which is like Objective-C 3.0. If anything, I expected them to just like make sort of a memory safe, no pointers allowed, no stars all over the place version of Objective-C.
That's what I expected. Because I think
with type inference, you know.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was a pragmatic way to go. And you expected it to, but so you got this. But this is not the kind of language that I think you, well, it's close, I suppose, but you were advocating for.
If you go through like my checklist, it's got most of the features that I was talking about, because, you know, from the language design perspective, you know, it's got, regular expressions, nothing in it precludes it. It's got name parameters. It's got, a cleaner syntax. It gets the types out of your face. It makes simple things simple. Mm-hmm. But it is a static language instead of dynamic. And the wild card that was in there was like, what I was imagining is a new language for you to write your applications in, akin to Objective-C. You use this language to write your GUI code. Mm-hmm. I was not thinking, you know, what we really need is a language to replace C in Core Foundation. That's not what I was thinking at all. And so here is a single language that is intending to do both of those jobs. And so on the outside, it looks like that language, a language that's, you know, has all those nice high level features and borrows from all the languages that I love, but it cannot be dynamic because it's supposed to scale all the way down. And that I did not predict, but it got more than I wanted in that new language, new name, new syntax. No one is confusing this with Objective-C.
Right.
It looks in performance, or not in performance, but in looks and semantics, like this is an entirely new language, so clearly filled with new ideas, not just every idea that we like from Objective-C just ported over, but there are new ideas in here, new ideas that may be scary, or, you know, borrowed from other languages, obviously, but it's you know, every language is influenced from a language, but it's a collection of someone's favorite features from other languages, including, much to the chagrin of many people, C++. Because, you know, LVM is written in C++, and I would imagine it's written by people who don't entirely despise C++.
No, I understand that they like it a lot, but they use a subset of it, right?
Well, I mean, like, everyone has something they hate about C++. So you can see in Swift in many ways is a damning comment on C++. Like, we see what you did there, C++, but you did it in the most horrible way possible because your language with a bazillion features is super old. We have a clean slate. We are going to try to get the benefits without the craziness. And maybe generics was a bridge too far, and that, like, it's like there's no way to do that cleanly. It's always crazy pants.
Yeah.
But, you know, operator overloading, like the complete will complain about, you can't do what Swift did with, you know, all the basic types in the standard library without operator. How would you add two numbers together? Right. You have to have operator overloading. And once you have it, to try to say, well, we have it, but it's only limited. Like, no, you have to have it. And, like, I think, you know, I'm a power programmer. I feel like it's reasonable for people to have some discipline in how they use these features. As long as the features aren't super dangerous, like a C++, where you could just shoot yourself in the foot so easily. Mm-hmm. Operator overloading is like, that's up to you whether you make something nonsensical. Like, the obfuscated C contest exists, but people don't say that C has, you know, too many features to make your code obscure, although the preprocessor is probably one, but not technically part of language.
No, I mean, you could run a preprocessor on Swift code if you wanted, which would be fun. I agree with what you're saying that, you can't make this language without operating overloading. I've had some awful experiences with it. On the other hand, I've used it often in games, especially if you want to add vectors or you want to, you know, multiply matrices together and stuff. There are very, very valid reasons to have it. I think when you start abusing it, like anything, it's...
Well, I mean, people should think about it. Not even like, because people always throw out the vectors, you know, and, you know, linear algebra and or imaginary numbers if you're feeling mathematical. Like, people throw those out, but I think that's the wrong way to think about it. What you should think about is use it for the same things that Apple uses it for, which is like, I want to add two numbers together. Sometimes they're integers and sometimes they're doubles, but it's a plus in both cases. Hey, operator overloading, right? Well, if you're going to add something like regular expressions to the language, they should have, or to the standard library, they should have some operators of their own. And that's another perfect opportunity for operator overloading. You're not like saying, take something that looks like something else and make it crazy, or use like an emoji operator to do pile of poo, something else, right?
Yeah.
You're going to add a feature to the language, like suddenly regular expressions are a thing. There is well-established syntax for dealing with regular expression substitutions in many other languages. Instead of just string dot, you know, replace or whatever you want to do, like, you can make operators out of this stuff, and it's not like you're making this up out of whole cloth and people are going to look at it and think it's crazy. Like, as it with everything else, people do not go insane when they see you know, plus for two numbers being added together. They're like, they're okay with that. They see it in all sorts of other languages. Well, if you make a bunch of operators for regular or range operators, like, oh, is that crazy? Not that crazy. Lots of languages have range operators these days. And you got to make up a bunch of characters for it. And really, it's just a function call with two different operands. And, like, it's fine, right? You're not trying to be clever by saying, wouldn't it be cool if you did this and then this funny character and this and it produced that? All you're trying to do is make it natural to use features that exist at this point in many other languages so that they will look familiar and be handy to use. And the thing about Swift is you don't have to add syntax to the language to do it. Like, you know, because it's so malleable that the bones are there for you to make a natural home for a feature. I would say don't, if you're not adding a feature like I'm adding regular expressions to the language, if you're not doing that, then don't try to get clever. In other words, like, consider the feature as existing for the benefit of the expansion of the language so that future features look natural in it and don't look like they're bolted on, even though everything technically is in a library. Think of it as, in my own end user code, I'm going to come up with a series of symbols that combine my types in novel ways. Because, like, what are you even doing there?
Right. So that brings me to the sort of the part of your Copeland piece that sort of didn't come to fruition yet, which is, you make the argument correctly, I think, that a new language is going to require new frameworks, right?
Well, they sort of got it, because here's where I think they got it is Swift has its own array type. Swift has its own string type. Yes, they're bridgeable, the NSRA, NS string, or whatever. But if you have a language like this, you need new syntax and I think new behavior to make it feel natural. And Swift does. Swift has new behavior for strings. It's new behavior for collection classes, dictionaries, arrays, alike. And it has the whole struct thing, which is like it has the very basics of the language. The most basic things you can do have to be different. They have to look different and they have to behave different for a modern language. It can't just be, here's a different syntax for calling methods on NSArray and NSString. Because those NSArray, NSString, and NSDictionary, the mutable and immutable versions, like that whole thing, it just is not a fit for Swift. Swift has optionals. Right. Swift doesn't need mutable and immutable. Like Swift has struct type, value type, and ref type. Like, they made a complete set of things while also balancing that, while spinning the plate to say also bridgeable to these other types, because it has to be, because we have to freaking call those APIs, right? It was a fairly amazing achievement to do that. Now, granted, what you're talking about is like, well, what does an API look like? But I'm saying they brought the basics and they made their own set of basics. I totally expected them to, you know, again, with the Objective-C 3.0 thing, like, well, NS string is fine, UTF-16, blah, 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 whatever. And, you know, NSArray is... it's all right, and it's dictionary, and immutable. It's kind of annoying, but everyone's used to it now. And they were like, "No, we're gonna make a language that makes that not an issue anymore." And it's gonna, everything, the basics in it are gonna look different and behave differently.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I think it's gonna be interesting going forward. As we were saying earlier, to see how the frameworks evolve, because I'm reminded of it because of what you were saying about using operator overloading to add features to the language. If everybody adds their own regex operator, then it's going to be havoc, right?
Well, so I mean, that's,
the sooner that's, Apple can do this stuff, the better.
Whenever they leave a void and everyone makes their own libraries. But like, the thing is, first, if you make your own library for your own project, or you just, you know, integrate PCRE or something and you make up your own syntax, no one's going to take that away from you. Like, it'll be fine. But if and when Apple does come out with something like that, you can wait a couple of releases for their version to shake out. And at some point you'll be like, no, I'm just going to use theirs. I'm tired of maintaining mine. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, you know, that's the beauty of the language. And if you leave the void too long, then it's just like everybody has their own pet thing. Or it's, you know, anytime you see really, like, with third-party apps or frameworks, if they become really popular and they're popular for years, that's kind of the signal that Apple is dropping the ball. Like, you just think of all of the various frameworks people use for, like, doing network services and stuff. And Apple kind of gets a signal of, like, I guess our network APIs are not that convenient to use because everybody is using the, what is that library that everybody uses for?
Oh man, you just got a BT something? No.
Well, this is all. I mean, Twitter is another example. Not that Apple needs to make a Twitter library, but anyway.
I don't know.
So they keep redoing the NSURL session and whatever. Like, so Apple notices that and tries again with new frameworks. Or, you know, CloudKit is a more egregious example where they kind of dropped the ball and everyone kind of did their own thing, and then CloudKit comes and it looks like the own thing that other people were doing.
I think the nightmare scenario here is, something like C++ strings, where every library's got its own different string type, and there's boost and standard one now, and you got to convert.
Apple's already protected from that. Like, they did strings, they did collections, they did, like, you know, it's just time constraints. Like, do you have time to do everything else? And I think a lot of things people maybe don't have the guts to do. Like, if Apple's going to add exceptions, mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone has the guts to try to do that themselves. They probably could, maybe. I don't know.
I've seen an implementation.
Right, but like, how do you feel about that versus, added a little bit of big, that's, especially since if Apple does that, it's going to become part of the, like, they're adding it for a reason. It will become part of their frameworks in whatever way they deem appropriate for Swift, like, how does Swift deal with exceptions?
Yeah.
Which may be different than how Objective-C deals with exceptions, but if you've made your own exception thing, that's not going to be compatible with whatever the hell Apple's doing, and so you're going to be forced to unify there. But other libraries, like networking libraries, or even just, like, the whole idea of using Swift as a scripting language, the basic functions on strings are still, again, without regular expressions or any similar functions, just doing stuff that would take you, you know, that would be straightforward to type even in JavaScript, are cumbersome in Swift. Like you dot off the end to look at the auto completions and you're just like, boy, there's not much here. Like, yes, there's a series. It's like Turing complete. There's if and while. I can technically do what I want to do with a series of substring and index processes, stuff, and copying the string 900 times and hope the optimizer gets rid of it, the inefficiencies. But it would be nice if we just had, you know, a simpler operator for substitutions and repetitions. And I mean, they've already got ranges, so.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And you're cool with the terse syntax, right? You like split and all of that kind of stuff rather than separated.
Yeah. I think that Swift has the same problem as Perl maybe it thinks there's a guiding principle, but if there is, I'm not discerning it enough. Right. But like, when is something a method and when is something a function? And I can sort of suss out why something is a method and why it's not a function eventually, if you think about like the types involved and what you would have to do and so on and so forth. But from the outside observer, it's sometimes weird. It's not like, you know, some language is like, oh, everything's a method. There's no functions anywhere. And then in Swift, there's a whole bunch of things that at various times either have been functions or still are functions. You're like, why isn't that a method? And you really have to puzzle it out. And so that is a weird mismatch of like, is this a language where all I do is type dot after everything and complete to a method? Or is this a language where I have a bunch of functions that I can call on things as well? And they're just, you know, imported and then I have to use them.
Well, you know, that'll shake out. And again, it goes to once Apple starts writing frameworks, we'll see the idiomatic approach that they take. I don't think anybody knows just yet because nobody's written enough.
I'm trying to think of the one that really threw me. Is it count elements, which is the one for instead of dot length? There's a couple of ones that are still head scratchers to me. And I fully believe that there are reasons for them. Like they're not doing it, making it arbitrary. But when you have a language where you have to kind of remember, because Perl is totally like this. I mean, at least in the case of Perl, what you have as your guide is like, is this a Unix system call? If so, then it's probably a function. If it's not a Unix system call, then, you know, maybe you can get it as a method. And so like that's a stupid guiding principle. It's like, oh, you haven't memorized all the Unix system calls. Well, then you'll just have to memorize that list. So now, you know, like this is a function that you call instead of, you know, the other way around. But
are there times in Perl where you've got both? Like, I can't think of one right now. Like,
file
string
IO.
Copy versus, okay.
No, file IO is a good one. Because there's a ton of ways to do OO file, IO.
So you can do like fopen or open like that.
Oh yeah, no. So you've got open, close. I mean, all the networking stuff, socket, like all everything, every Unix system call you can think of. Sometimes it has the F prefix removed because it doesn't make any sense. But those are all there. But there's also, you know, socket objects that you can call methods on and set attributes on that under the covers are using those other ones. Like it's a layering type thing. But it's like, why would I ever use the function ones? Why don't I just always use the object ones? And if I have a file handle, I can do print file handle string to print that string to the file handle. But I can also do file handle, not dot, but basically the equivalent arrow print. So I can call the print method or I can call the print function. Sometimes in the same freaking file handle. You're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, you have to understand that print is kind of like printf, and that's always been a function, and that was there first. And then the object-oriented approach where you can just call the print method on a file handle. You can also call the close method on the file handle, or you can call the close function and pass the file handle to the close. And it starts becoming maddening again if you don't understand the history behind it. Swift doesn't have any history yet, so that dichotomy is not as glaring, but it's still a little weird.
Yeah, and they said they were going to, but I was very happy that they fixed the way the collections worked. Because initially, what was it? If you had a static collection and you assigned it into something else, then you could mutate it.
I think it was a weird thing of like, if you use a subscript to modify it, it didn't count as a mutation and you wouldn't get a copy. You wouldn't get a copy of it.
Yeah.
But if you mutated it in a different way, it would give you a copy. It was some basically like difference in behavior based on how you accessed it.
Yeah. And it was trying to be cute because it didn't want to do a bunch of memory copies, right?
It was exposing the efficiencies of the optimization were exposed through the semantics of the collection. And you didn't want that.
Right. And I was really happy to see that they fixed that. Because when I started complaining about it, I had a bunch of people telling me I was goofy and that it was for optimization.
I mean, yeah, no, because as soon as you have it explained to you, you're like, well, don't you understand? If we do it this way, this is blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I know, but it doesn't make any sense from the outside. And it's, yeah. They did the hard thing and said, okay, we'll make it make sense from the outside. And then we will endeavor to make these semantics, which are much simpler to understand, we'll try to make them fast.
Right. It just gave me a lot of hope that they're willing to, to move off of something that they... they can see it as a mistake and move on with life, right?
Well, I mean, they may be on, it's good in many ways, but they may be on the same page as the, speaking of page, as pages, like where you can't read this document because it's too old, right? That whole thing people always complain about Twitter today. I've been seeing it again. Like that whole idea, like that some Microsoft Word engineer is just on a fainting couch every time that dialogue comes up. Yeah. What are you talking about? You're not going to open the guy's document that he made with last year's version of your program. You're going to tell him to first open it up with the old version and then save it. Like, that's crazy. Like, it's the most just brutal backwards compatibility thing. And yet Swift is kind of on the same page, but like, we'll make sure that your binaries still work.
Yeah.
Is that okay? And it's like, what about my source? Your source? Let's talk about your source. If we change the array semantics again, all your source is completely broken. So I hope you have a binary that you built with the previous version of Swift, because if you try to build a PM with a new thing, maybe it won't even compile, or maybe it will compile, do something totally different. Because guess what? We changed the semantics of the collection classes. So good luck with that. So that's the, how fast they're willing to move forward. It's like, yeah, you made that with last year's version of Swift, but you can't even compile that with this year's version of Swift. So good luck porting your program over. Make sure you find all the places where you use collection classes and make sure they comply with the new semantics. Syntax hasn't changed. It looks exactly the same, but now we make copies in cases where we didn't. And that's
the worst. Like, semantic changes like that, that's brutal, because they can't even get flagged for you, right?
Right. I mean, the whole thing is like that they will, make source, they make some sort of tool like that will migrate your source from one thing to the other and highlight. They've done this so many times and highlight the places where you may have done it wrong or whatever, but it just shows how willing they are to just plow bravely forward without being held back by like, but we have, and this is the time to do it when nobody has millions of lines of code written in Swift yet, right? Like, hurry up and do all this breaking stuff now before somebody writes a major application in it, because then, it's the whole reason. You had Adobe knocking on your door and saying, we're not going to rewrite Photoshop in Objective-C. So I don't know what you're thinking there. So it's like, all right, Carbon, blah, blah, blah. And how many years did it take to get, a quote-unquote Cocoa version of Photoshop?
Right. Yeah, I mean, those guys are in a pickle. I mean, so I don't see Objective-C going away anytime for, a long time.
I mean, C and C++ are all still there. I don't know if you're ever going to get rid of Objective-C in the same way. I don't think you're ever going to get rid of C or C++. Like the whole, it's a layer cake. Like the assembler's still there in the bottom in those routines that need it for, virtual memory or whatever, or some OpenGL thing or something. And then you've got the whole layer cake all the way up, but you never get rid of it. You just keep putting new dirt on top. You don't get rid of the lower layers.
Yeah. So that's going to be interesting. They have they're going to have double support loaded, kind of, while they maintain the Objective-C stuff and, build out some Swift stuff.
It'll be a transition. Like, it's interesting to see what the transition is like. Like, for Cocoa got kept around way longer than I bet a lot of people wanted it to be. Just because
Cocoa?
We talk about, not Cocoa, Carbon.
Cocoa, yeah.
Talk about double support burden. Remember when like new UI elements would come out and some of them would be Carbon only and some of them would be Cocoa only? That was crazy. That was just like, they must have had meetings like, what are we doing, guys? And they'd have in each WWC session, they'd be like, they'd come to the slide that says, if you want to use this from insert Carbon or Cocoa here, but you're using insert Carbon or Cocoa here, then you have to and you hear people groan, and it would be like, there's no rhyme or reason. It's just like, this team did it in Carbon, this team did it in Cocoa. And the next year they'd say, and guess what? And now you can use this from insert Carbon or Cocoa here, whatever the opposite was last year. And people would celebrate. It's like, that's a lot of wasted effort there. Maybe you could just pick one UI library and work on that one and add all the new widgets to that one. And so for all of the, pain over Carbon going away, it was crazy when that was going on. So I hope they're not going to repeat that with Swift, and I hope it's just going to be more of, again, the brutal pages approach of saying, this new API is only available in Swift. It will only ever be available in Swift. You cannot use it for Objective-C. Sorry. Or you can't, subclass it in Objective-C or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Take a quick break so I can tell you about lynda.com. It is an easy and affordable way to help individuals and organizations learn, instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on software, web development, graphic design, and more. So I know a lot of you know about lynda.com. If you don't already, it is just the best place on the internet to learn. I've jokingly said this before, but I actually mean it. You can just plug lynda.com into you like the Matrix and learn anything from web development to app development to Photoshop to Yosemite to iOS, anything that you want to learn, you can learn it like you're jacked into the Matrix. There's fresh content. New courses are added daily. They're taught by industry experts. The people you hear and see on Twitter and on the internet talking about these things, they are the ones teaching them to you. It's high quality. It's easy to follow. It goes from beginner to advanced courses. And there's great tools like searchable transcripts, playlists, certificates of course completion. And all of it can be completed on your iPhone, on your iPad, on your Android phone, or on your computer. So you can learn the best way and the best place for you and the best time for you. You can watch a little bit, you can watch a lot. And the best thing is that you get all of it for one low monthly price of $25. That gives you access to over 100,000 video tutorials. You know, since Lynda's been a sponsor on several of the shows, I've been talking to a lot of people who have tried them out. And inevitably, it all comes back to the same thing that it comes down to for me is, yes, you could go and find a school or find a course or try to find somebody to mentor you or teach you. But you know, a lot of that is a lot of work. It's a lot of hours. It's a lot of heavy lifting. And Lynda has done all that for you. They've got the best people in the world. They've put it together into the best courses, and they just stream it. Not right to your brain, but pretty close, right to your device. There's even premium plans where you can upgrade. You can download the courses for offline learning. You can download project files. You can practice along with your instructor. Some of the newest courses are managing your mobile photos, Google Docs and Sheets for iOS First Look, iPad for Business, up and running with OpenGL, creating mobile games with Unity. There really is something for everyone. If you are making code, if you are running a business, if you are, you know, doing accounting, whatever you are weak in, this will help you get strong. So we've worked out an offer with Lynda. So here's what I want you to do. Go to lynda.com/debug. And you can try lynda.com for free for 7 days. Go in there. Take a look at any course you want. Learn anything that you want. They're betting that once you try it, you're going to like it. And I'm betting that too. So that's lynda.com, lynda.com/debug. Thanks, Lynda.
So speaking about ditching legacy Mac technologies, file extensions.
The file name extensions. People keep finding file extensions are not a thing. File name extensions. They're extensions on the name of the file. File extensions makes you sound like someone's grandparents.
Okay, file name extensions.
Yes.
Tell me how you feel. I heard you going off on me at the end of the talk show, so I wanted to give you a chance to...
Gruber was trying to represent the position of the Mac users, but...
You felt he didn't do a good enough job?
Yeah, I mean, so...
I don't think we're really arguing about this, but...
We will. But, so the thing with file name extensions, like, he did a good job of trying to express the insanity of them, using a lot of examples examples that everyone has used. Like, the whole idea that the file name is something that the user can edit. The user picks the file name, you can edit the file name. And yet editing the file name changes nothing about the file except for the name. There's nothing you can type there that will change the contents of that file, right? It's just the name. You can't type anything there that will change the insides of the file. So if you're going to put anything in the file name, anything other than the name in the file name, it would actually be better, for example, to put the creation date in the file name. Because the creation date is arbitrary. If you type a different creation date in the file name, have you changed the creation date? Well, not really, but for the purposes of, you know, you haven't changed when the file was created, but you might as well have. Like, you can say, I would like the computer to think this file was created 1 minute later than it really was. Fine, you have. Like, there's no problem with that other than, it, you know, you're lying to the computer. But you haven't created a lie. Like, once you make that change, you type my file dot, and then you put the creation date, because the creation date is always in the file name, because that's just the way computers work, right? Because it's exactly as arbitrary as anything else there. That's fine. It's still valid. Whereas if you put type information in the file name and you change a JPEG to .txt, you've now created a lie. Like, that is not true. That is not a text file. You've created an invalid. It's like a database with constraint violations, right? Yeah. That data is wrong. Right? And that points to the insanity of putting type information in a user editable place, because you can't, you typing doesn't make it so. You cannot type something there. It's so easy to actually create a situation where that type information is incorrect, is not serving its purpose. Its purpose is supposed to be to describe the type of the file. And it gets even worse when you start tying up, oh, not just type of the file, but also the creating application, because if it's a text application that was created by the whatever app, I call it .dat. And even though it's a plain text file, it's really a .dat file, and those open in the .dat editor, you know, whatever. Like, once you start overloading and say not only the type, but also the creator you could put there too, because it's fine to lie about that. But if you combine the type and the creator in one little string after a dot, it's totally messed up, right? And we all agree that's stupid, right?
Yeah. So yeah, certainly I agree that I'm not sure I follow with the creator code, but yes, having a.
But I'm just saying, like, if you try to use one string to, if you don't have separate information about, like, think of all the things you could say, what you can describe about a file, what app created it, what app do I want to open it when I double click it, what is the type of the data in the file, like, you can think of all sorts of things.
You did say the .dat is just simple text file, right?
Right. Well, that's okay. Why, you know, so.
No, I just want to understand. I was thinking like a WordPerfect format file versus a Word format file.
I might have picked a legitimate extension that existed, but like type information is actually fiendishly complicated because that's why UTIs exist, because, well, it's a plain text file, but it's also an XML file. Is an XML file a plain text file? Yeah, but it's also an XML file. So there's a hierarchy. That's why, you know, the whole big thing I did about UTIs, which is Apple's Uniform Type Identifiers, creates a hierarchy of types. MIME is a kind of a start, like text/plain, but MIME doesn't go far enough. UTIs goes much farther, and it's a taxonomy. It's very difficult to suss out, but UTIs have enough richness in them to describe. But anyway, the point is there's lots of different things you can say about a file, all sorts of dates you can say about it. You can talk about specs like size, for example. That's another great example. If we put size in the file name, typing different size, not change the size of the file. Like you're just creating corruption. That is corruption. That's invalid data, right?
Yeah.
But also, who created it? What app do I want it to open in when I double click it? What is the type of the file? The more, you know, combining all of those into one thing that's in the file name is crazy, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So we know.
We all agree on.
All right. So, file name extensions are terrible, right? And so, if you want to move away from them to something else, as Apple did, like, for compatibility reasons or whatever. First of all, I'm not entirely sure that needed to be done, because in the dawning of the web age, type information about data on the web is not contained in a dot followed by a bunch of letters in the URL. There's a separate field called content type in the HTTP protocol that specifies the type. Granted, it does it using MIME and not UTIs, because UTIs didn't exist then, which is fine, but at least it's separate. I can call the URL whatever I want. I can type gobbledygook. I send it as, you know, image JPEG. The browser is going to say image JPEG and render it. And in the past, this had not been true in crappy browsers that would go off the. But these days, it's more or less true. But the point is, the protocol was there. Like, there's no reason you need file name extensions for the web.
Right.
If still, though, you're living back in the 90s and you're like, well, what a web schmeb. I need to put things on floppy disks and bring them over to someone's computer, and they need to be able to double click it. And those computers aren't going to be Macs, because most computers in the world are Windows and blah, blah, blah. If you have to do something for backward compatibility, which is debatable, especially now in light of the Mac being the only PC line that's actually making any money and actually growing. So even that could have been a dumb short-term decision.
Yeah, but we're talking about something, a decision made 16 years ago, basically.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, you got to think ahead. Quartz was long-term thinking. You know, iOS running on the OS X was long-term thinking. Adopting file name extensions was not long-term thinking. And it's looking
fair enough. No, I think if anything, I see it as a defensive move.
All right. So say you just decide you got to do that anyway.
Because I do agree that it is dumb. Like, yes, dumb.
So you have to support file name extensions, because you just think of it as like a ploy of like, if we're compatibility with their crap, that's like a way we can usurp them, you know, brace and extend or whatever.
Because the finder is going to have to look at like a
Windows share mounts, or whatever you think is like, even if you have to do that, right? Even if that's your strategy. Like, the things that Apple did for that strategy of, like, hiding the file name extension and optionally hiding and doing the clever editing, you know, like, if you type in if the file name extension is hidden, but it's .txt and you type .txt, that is essentially equivalent to revealing it. It doesn't double the .txt. Like, they sorted out all that stuff, and they tried to deal with the ugliness of hiding and showing, and it's not great. And you can still end up with a situation where you have three files who all have apparently the same name, but they don't, because there's a hidden extension that you can't see, and all sorts of confused stuff. But anyway, they deal with that. Their one big mistake was doing all this compatibility stuff and then constructing their own OS to say the place where you get type information from a file is by looking at that file name extension and translating it to like a UTI or something. That was the big mistake. What they should have done is said the official location for file type information on Macs, on iOS, on any place else is an extended attribute that contains a UTI or whatever thing they wanted to do. That would be the one true canonical place to type it. If that information is not there, fall back to the current system. So you need to have a mapping between them because you got to figure out what it's the same thing that exists now. You look at the file name extension, try to figure out the UTI. The problem is that there are sets of file name extensions for which 50 different UTIs could be valid. If you put the canonical location as an extended attribute, then you can deal with that. You can deal with 15 files called, you know, .xml or say five apps try to claim .dat, which happens all the time. Like apps try to claim there's no universal registry of file name extensions. If there is, people wouldn't pay attention to them anyway. Like how if you had, you know, Mac and iOS apps fighting over that, like let Windows deal with that. We'll throw the file over the fence to them. They can figure out how three different apps who all want .dat can deal with each other. On our side, we have an extended attribute that tells me the exact type and the exact creator using com.companyname.whatever. And like all the metadata could be in extended attributes in an awesome form, whatever form we think that is. If we think MIME is crap, we use UTIs. If we think, you know, bundle identifier is great for the creating application, do we want to put version information in there? Whatever we want to put, extensible metadata, all the technology is there, put it there. And all it is a policy change, not really a tech change. You just say that's where all our APIs look first. If it's not there, we look in this other place. You tell Mac and iOS applications, create both. Always create a file name extension, always create that attribute. You don't have to create the file name extension, always create the attribute. If the user deletes the file name extension, still create the attribute. The thing will still work correctly, right? Always add creator information as an extended attribute. If you lose that information, so what? You know, like all the existing compatibility things could be there. And then if there comes a time when you don't think you need to put the file name extension by default, you can change that policy decision too. But the point is all your APIs and all your apps were always using separate, much richer attributes that are able to contain more information than a series of strings broken down into, you know, separate extended attributes. That was the mistake.
Okay. One minor point is when they were doing this, back in 98, 97.
No extended attributes? Well, yeah. I was asking for them too, but for this very reason.
I know, it's just, that's a quibble. The other thing that I kind of want to put aside is the creator codes, because that's a per user thing rather than a file type thing.
Well, it's not, it's just metadata. Like, I wouldn't use creator codes because those were, you know, 32-bit integers.
Oh, yeah, no, but I mean, the creating app, right? Like, you'd need...
The bundle identifier, yeah.
No, but what if you want to open it in an HTML file?
It doesn't matter.
Web
all you're recording is historical record. You're recording what app created this, right? The policy for what
should
happen.
There's a shared file on the network. You can see it, and I can see it.
No.
When you edit it, you want to see it in Coda. When I edit it, I want to see it in a
whole separate issue. What you want to do when you create the file is accurately represent all the information you have about the file. It's up to the application, whoever's looking at the file, to make a policy decision based on all the information available to it as to what the behavior should be. Your policy on your machine can be different than the policy on my machine. You still might need, and this is a more
you need it on
case.
A per file basis, because I have Coda and the web browser, and I want to Coda my stuff.
I know, but like what you could say then is just say all files with file name extension blah. Ignore the creating application when I open files of this type, right?
Files that I want to open in Coda that are on my machine, and I've got yours on a share that I want to look at. Yeah.
So the final stage of this, which is more difficult, is you have to have per user extended attributes, which Apple hasn't implemented. You could do in various hacky ways where you've got your own database of profile attributes based on file ID or something.
Yeah. Okay.
Or perfect. You could build it into the file system. But either way, even if you don't do that, as long as the application's sole responsibility is to accurately reflect the metadata, then every individual machine can choose which of that metadata it wants to use for its policies on a profile basis or a profile type basis. Like you could say, if you see .dat, ignore the creator code and always open it in the default opening application for .dat files like this.
Yeah.
You just need the metadata to be there, right? And someone else could have a different policy on their machine and deal with it the same way. Per user attribute overrides, like, I mean, see all the crazy crap they do with like, I guess labels are extended attributes too, and they have the same problem there. But like, you could have a local database with a bunch of file IDs for local, right? Like, presumably, it wouldn't be, you know, like you can't do per user extended attributes in the file system because you have the whole NFS user ID mismatch universal registry. Like, long term, you know, 50 years in the future, maybe we get that sorted out if we get identity sorted out and everything. But for now, you can do all sorts of hacks with local databases that deal with the exceptional conditions. But in all cases, it is no worse than what we have today, and it can be much better. Like, for example, your policy could be never, ever look at any of those extended attributes, behave exactly like the Mac does today. And that is a viable policy for your local machine.
Sure. Now, wait. So, per user attributes, I think, are going to be required. I mean, even for the labels, like you said, and there's probably other stuff that you want to do.
I mean, look what they did with labels. They just punted. It's just a bunch of numbers. And yeah, guess what? No. Your purple may be my green. There's not we can do about it.
Yeah, that's not even EA. Well, I mean, it's part of the HFS.
No, it's not. Stuff, yeah, so, yeah. I know, but like there is having color labeled files on a share that's looked at by a bunch of Mac users is basically chaos. Because like no one is seeing the same colors. Yeah. No one has the same label names. It's just like, But I say that, we said it from a technical perspective, but I bet there are people right now who are labeling files red. Everyone in their office has the default and everyone sees it as red and they see absolutely no problem with this.
Sure. Yeah. And I want to just make it clear that I agree with you that adding extended attributes and metadata to files is aces. I'm all up for that.
And that was their escape hatch. Like that's what they needed to do. That's what I was asking for. Make extended attributes, catalog all the information in them, and critically make that the official location for this information. Because now you have all these series of APIs in Cocoa and all these other classes that look at the file name extension and sort of gin up a UTI based on that. And you just can't do it because there is no direct, like it is a lossy conversion there. There are file name extensions that just like this could be one of 17 UTIs. I have no idea which one it's going to be. And there's a fight over which one. And you can't distinguish because there is no more information in the file. All you've got is dot and whatever, however many letters you have after that.
Yeah.
And there's no place else for you to look because it's not part of the official API.
Right. So I agree with you. I think workplace, you can actually get UTIs back and forth, but you're right. I think they can get written into an EA, but whatever.
It's a policy decision. You just have to have said from now on, that's always the first place we look. That is always the official place of the information. If the information is not there, we will derive it from all available other information and then write it there. So and I if we can't it, write it there, then we'll just derive it every time, right? You know, like it just falls back to the existing behavior, but it's so important. Apple should know this, and anyone who makes the API, it's so important to have like, to make that difference, like saying this is the official location, and then we have a series of scenarios where we can get it when it's not there. That leads you to a future where you can be like, well, this was always the official position. Every application is writing it. Every Mac application is reading it. And if file name extensions become ridiculous, it's so easy to just say, like people just change their habits. Like we don't even have to change anything. We've always been doing it this way.
Right. So I agree with you that maybe this is the way we should move forward more than in a second. Where I think I kind of disagree is back at the time, I think it was untenable to try to go down this path because like you said, all of the APIs, the Cocoa APIs at least, and Foundation were based off file name extensions. Well,
but extended attributes came in 10.4, I believe, and UTIs came around the same similar time frame.
Yeah, they could have been working on this for a long time. That I'll grant you that for right. Sure.
They said so early on that like file name extensions are it. That is the official location. Knowing full well the insane limitations of file name extensions, you just simply cannot express things in file name extensions that are expressible with UTIs or other things. Ignoring all those things, like they just made the decision, this is what it's going to be, and then let's stop talking about it. And so much so, they made that so early that even when they sort of, you know, by the way, incidentally, we just created extended attributes for Spotlight and Time Machine, and we just created UTIs. They didn't think to revisit that thing. What else could we use this? Like, you know, you got to do what you got to do in the short term, but like to sort of commit to that and to say, and we will never revisit this issue. File name extensions are fine, is an anti-Apple thing. And that's what Gruber is getting at. Like, we Mac users spent so many years, we could name our files whatever the hell we wanted. Everything worked fine, except when we tried to exchange files with the disgusting world of Windows. And the web kind of came along and saved us from having to deal with that because who shares files anymore? Everything is all, you know, magic and cloud-based, and it comes down with a MIME type header or whatever. But we were forced to regress. And it's like, if this was a temporary regression on the way to something better, fine. But it was like, it's like a permanent regression. They're like,
okay. Yeah. I get it. That's where I don't think, I mean, clearly this is not as good. File name extensions are the dumb idea. They're a pragmatic idea. And I was fine with that at the time. The fact that, yeah, you're right. The fact that we haven't progressed more.
And it was right there in front of them. Like, there was not, like, extended attributes weren't that far away from that decision. Like,
no, 10, no.
Yeah. 10.4 was relatively close to, you know.
They started using all the pasteboard stuff with it.
The beginning of OS 10, right?
And
when they went and made that stuff anyway and didn't revisit, like, that was the worst, you know. It's like, you did all this work. You did all this hard work. And there it is, and nothing. Like, use it in a ways that you would think would be like the secondary and tertiary things. Like, now that we have these extended attributes that we're totally using for type and creator information, and we got rid of resource forks, we got rid of creator codes, we have bundle identifiers, they're great. We got UTIs, they're great. You know what else we can do with this? We could use it to label things for our backup system, and we use it for ACLs. Like, that should be like the second and third tier uses. Instead, those are like the first things they used it for, and they just skipped right over type information and creator information, all that other stuff.
Well, it's good. It's because the ACLs and the time machine stuff are Unixy kind of guys, right? So that they didn't think of that.
But it was like
they probably just did not think of it.
But the thing about it is, like, you know, the extended attributes, like arbitrary extensible metadata. That sounds crazy. You're not going to have, like, that sounds like that weird esoteric feature is not going to get used. And like the first thing Apple does with it is they make it basically that every file on your hard drive is going to have a copy that's going to have at least one extended attribute. Like, Time Machine just puts extended attributes in every single freaking file in your entire hard drive. Like, they didn't just, like, we'll start using it for something small that only gets used. we're going to use it. They went from having zero extended attributes to having at least one for every file in your hard. I forget how many extended attributes files on Time Machine have, but I think it's a lot.
Yeah, there are a lot. I mean, the argument could be made if they get stripped off during a copy, it doesn't matter. But
yeah, well, I mean, they built their backup system on it. Like, that's the crux of it, you know. And granted,
no,
that's
actually,
all.
Actually, wait. Here's the problem. Sorry, not to interrupt you. I've got a myphoto.jpg, and I've got the EA calling it whatever the UTI is, public.image.jpg, whatever. I rename it myimage.jpg. I take off the JPG and the dot because they're dumb. Then I copy that file to a Windows system. What happens?
Yeah, same thing that would happen if you ignore the extended attribute. If you do that, the same thing happens that if you did it with and without the extended attributes. If the extended attribute gets lost, it gets lost, but it's not even there now. So you're no worse than you are.
No, yeah, but the Windows person can't open it like at all. So if I drag it into an email.
Okay, yeah, email, but they couldn't open it at all at this point.
They could when it was called .jpg.
I know, but you removed it. So pretend we're in the current world and you do that. You're in exactly the same situation.
Oh, you mean because it was my choice that I did? You sure? Okay.
Yeah. Like, I mean, if you want to actually change people's habits, like, I'm not even, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's never going to be worse than it is today, right? Because any scenario that you just describe, we'll just take the extended attribute out of the equation. It's exactly, you know, would say, well, people wouldn't do that if they had the expectation that blah, blah, blah. You know, you're out if you wanted to say, not only do we want to put this information in the right place just for future proofing, because we know that we can migrate away from it and we can have richer APIs based on it. But we also want to change the user's habits to get them so they feel like they do own the file name again. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the hiding sort of makes them feel like they own the file name already, but imposes a whole other thing of, like, they really don't know what the real file name is. And when they see it as an attachment, suddenly has an extension and they don't know what type it is unless they get info on it. Anyway, if you want to change user habits, you're out there is, with the richness of the extended attributes on your system, it's very easy to make an API that says, take this file and express its type information as a file name extension if it isn't already there.
Yeah.
Because a system level API that can be done anytime very easily that applications can call when they know the file is leaving the system. Hell, the Finder could call it when you copy it onto a network share for all you care, right? Yeah. Like, it's you know, I don't necessarily recommend that because that is a harder sell than what I'm saying, which is basically keep everything the same, but just let the experience on the Mac be richer. You're never losing anything. It's never worse than it is now. You're not asking people to change their habits. You're not asking them to know more or less than they do about the crazy hidden extensions now. Like, just, this could be, if I could snap my fingers, this could happen on everyone's Mac today, no one would notice, right? But just, you want to keep it there so that going forward, you are future-proofing, you are making it possible to have richer experiences on the Mac in the future. And when you do, the entire software stack is already doing all the right things. So it's just a question of going, you know what? I prefer to have this behave this way. It's like, well, you can, because guess what? Every app in your system has been writing UTIs and creator information as a bundle code and also the information extended attributes that are entirely independent, and you can make your policies based on it and you're fine. And we can write this little SQLite database off to the side with your profile overrides. And if you lose them, doesn't matter. You're still just back to where you are.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so, I think that You're right. They probably should have started doing that way earlier. And certainly capturing all of that metadata is like, that's never a bad thing, right?
And it was like, I think it's like, one is priorities. Like, you know, there's more, kind of more important things going on in the Silly Fine extender stuff. But two, and the thing that sticks in Micro and Gruber's and stuff is all Mac users is, this is a value that we as Mac users held dear and had. It was part of what made the Mac great. And it was one of the things that was lost in the transition to the next leadership. And they valued it less than we did, maybe because they hadn't experienced it, maybe because they didn't think it was important. Obviously, it was still, I'm going to say, a net win still to have those next guys take over, because, hey, that worked out pretty well for us, huh? Yeah. But as in not going out of business. But yeah, that was something that made the Mac special. And to this day, there is no competing system that is more friendly than the Mac was in this way. We lived in this honeymoon period of, you know, 10, 15 years, where everyone else was in this barbaric world where they had to do things in service of the computer when they named their files, and we can name ours whatever the hell we wanted.
Yeah, so I was going to say it was 10, 15 years, but it was also 10, 15 years ago. So
yeah, I know, but it was like, it's a weird, for people who lived through it, it was like, this is so clearly the future. Like the GUI, it's as if we used the GUI and everyone said, you know what, no, back to the command line. And we'd be like, remember those 10 years we had the GUI, and they're like, well, the GUI lost, sorry. command line.
Yeah. I don't mean to be like that. I'm not dismissive of the idea. I do wonder, though, if we are more likely to see the file system as it is exposed go away before we see this kind of thing done. Like,
well, I mean, so here's the thing about that. Like,
it's hard to do. I mean, we're going to need to look at the file system anyway, right? But it's maybe not everybody.
First of all, you always have to have a file system to store your data. This will get into an HFS plus discussion if we're not careful. No, but anyway, like you need some place to put the bytes, right? And whether the user sees that on us is an independent concern. It would be nice if the place to hold the bytes was better at holding bytes and keeping track of them, right?
Yes.
Whatever, all right. But then from the UI perspective, there's still kind of the process of writing words to describe things and attaching metadata to them so you can find them again, because a file path is just a distributed series of metadata. Anyway, it's like you have a blob of data and you can make a bunch of words associated with it. That's all you could model a file system as simply you have a blob of data and you have name value pairs, and that's it, because that's all the current file system is. Implementation wise, some of the name value pairs, we have slashes between them, we call that one the path, and that's silly details, but that's it. So you're still going to have at some point someone typing something to say, I'm going to call this and put this here, whether you want to use that metaphor of put this here, because again, it's all completely a metaphor, even with file paths. Yeah. There has to be some way that you do something to make it so you can find this thing again, whatever that is. And I think we're never going to get to the point where just the content of the file is enough. You're always going to want to be able to name something. That is much independent of file name extensions, but...
Well, I'm thinking about like iPhoto, or in the file open dialog, now you can go to the photos thing, right, and see everything that's in your iPhoto.
Yeah, but like I'm thinking of when people name something, like you may have like a dog named Jim and a cousin named Jim, but you don't get really confused because one's a dog, one's a person.
Right.
And like that's type information, right? And so I think you still also need some way to attach type information to things, because it's natural for people to want to have something called like plans, and one of them is like a vector drawing program that has plans for your house, and plans, and one of them is like, I don't know, a series of plans that you're going to make for weddings or something. Mm-hmm. And to understand that one of them belongs to your, like, is a vector drawing thing that belongs to a drawing program, and another one is like a text document, right? And you want to call them both plans. You're not confused about which is which, because of all the ways that the interface shows us they're different. They have different icons. Maybe they're in different quote-unquote folders, which is just different metadata. And yes, maybe they have different file name extensions, which is a visible manifestation of their type, which could be presented in many other ways. Mm-hmm. So I think this whole issue is mostly orthogonal to where any of those bits of information are stored. And I think the harder problem is how do you let people express and deal with their notion of what identifies a chunk of information. Because all those things, I think, are natural ways to identify a piece of information. And we need to have some way for people to file things away with that information and to say, where is the picture that I called foo versus where is the, you know, program that I was writing that I called foo, and to distinguish those. And, you know, and I think the current metaphor of putting things in places and nested folders, as troublesome as it is, has merits to it, and I think the only merit that is remaining untapped is my favorite hobby horse of the spatial finder, but a springboard is getting a little bit closer to that, maybe.
Yeah.
Of like, where did I put that upper left, three things over, down the hall, in the room over here with the green tile? Like,
yeah. I've always been sold on your spatial finder argument.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's an aspect of interfaces that if you do not take advantage of it, you are leaving UI money on the table. And if you thwart it and do things that are counter to it, is it a bad experience? So all that sounds like it's different than the file system, but it all has to do with how people identify things and find them or whatever. And mm-hmm. I don't talk about it much anymore, but I will be on this until the day I die. That there's no like. Humans have evolved to live in a 3D world where things are in places. And those skills that our brains is good at, remembering where things are, how to go from place to place, how to reach for things, and like, that's not going away. Evolution does not work that fast. It's going to be with us for millions more years. Tough luck. We're all until we all, you know, go off into the matrix and we don't have physical manifestations anymore. Those skills are incredibly powerful, and any interface that does not take advantage of them is necessarily less than it should be. And I think for this particular task of what do I call this thing and where do I put it and how do I find it again? You absolutely have to take advantage of those skills, because those are the same skills we use to find our keys in the morning and, you know, to find our house where we live and how to navigate our house without hitting walls and all these things that we do every day. This is the computer version of that. Where is that thing? What did I put it? What does it look like? Is this person my wife or is this person not my wife? Like recognition, it doesn't mean you have to have a spatial finder. It just means that this has to be part of the mix. If it's not, if you think you're going to do it all by someone typing a string in a box and finding things like the everything is Spotlight, everything is Google search, like that's not leveraging the best of us.
Right. No, I agree. I'd say I organize spatially, but I almost disorganize spatially just because I just know where stuff is, right? And it's filed away in my head somewhere, and I know where to go find my glasses.
It's in your mind palace.
Yeah, I mean, and you're going to lose stuff, and people still lose things in the file system too, but you rarely lose track of your ears. And like, you know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to find your nose to scratch it, it's there, right? And so, like, it's a hierarchy of things. You can always find your ears, you can usually find your glasses. You're pretty sure you know where you live most of the time. If you're sober, like, it's a hierarchy, but at a certain point, you're like, where is that piece of paper I saw 3 months ago? It would be nice if we could fall back to search, which the computers can do, but it's a hierarchy, and you definitely... Yeah. You don't want to have to use, grep to find where you live every day. It should be in a place that you can find using other attributes that don't involve typing things into boxes.
Yeah, that I totally agree with. I do prefer, and I use all the time, the column browser mode. But only because the finders still, the rules just confuse the crap out of me.
Oh, that's my enemy. Like it thwarts your ability to ever arrange even the things you use every day in a sensible manner. You'll think you'll have a setup that's kind of to your liking, and then all of a sudden one of your windows will be in the wrong place with a crazy sidebar and a thing, and it's just like, why? Like, you're just betraying me. And Springboard is a nice, Springboard is like the insanity people feel, especially me, if you have some sort of bug where Springboard just scrambles all your icons. You feel like someone blew up your house. You feel like someone just came into your house and just turned it over, like, you know, a cop movie where like they go through and just turn the place over, right? And you're just like, what? You feel violated. You're like, what the hell? And like, and you can't. And the worst part is, you can't even remember where everything was. Like, where did this dish go? Like, I don't remember what drawer this clothes was. Like, seriously, if I could have an iOS virus that took people's icons on Springboard and just scrambled them, took everything out of folders, re-scrambled, put things back into folders, and they just woke up in the morning and found that, it would be the most devastating virus in the world in terms of emotional angst, because it's like people wouldn't know where the hell anything is anymore. And like, I know some people who you know, do that to themselves. Like, sometimes you can't find your keys because your house is messy. Sometimes everyone just swipes down and does search because they don't know where anything is except for the things in their dock or on page one of Springboard. But
that's actually me. I've got page one, maybe one and one and a half, and everything.
And
else
then everything just, after that is search. Like, but that's, you know, everyone has their own hierarchy. Some people have 7 pages memorized. Some people can barely memorize the first page. But all those people, if I scrambled everything randomly, they'd be like, where the hell is the text message app? And they'd be just swiping through looking for green. Like, you know,
and I can't even imagine that one moving.
And if you take away green, so, like maybe I change all the icons to grayscale, you can't even look for the green square. How many people know what messages looks like other than it's green? Like, did it have a bubble in it? Or was it a circle? Did it say messages? Do I have to read the text under every icon to find it?
Yeah, you give me the heebie-jeebies.
Also, Springboard does take advantage of these things. Finder is like, F you, your window may look like anything. But like any, my application window, I know how I want it on my Mac, / application, 64 pixel icons, sorted by name, with grid spacing, so I can fit maybe four of them in a big vertical window. And just routinely, every month or two, I'll open that window, it'll be list view. I'll change it into icon view. The icons will be in the wrong place and the wrong size. I'll just like, it's like, why do I have to keep doing this? Like, it is my enemy. It does not want you to get to arrange things in any way that is pleasing to you. It will just say, nope, that's moving today.
No, that's why I gave up and just, I always liked the column view mode, but I like column view and icon view, but the icon view is just so unreliable because random stuff happens. So I just gave up. I just really gave up. My desktop is all kind of spatial.
I still
know where everything is on my desktop, but
it's the one thing the Finder hasn't totally lost, which I think would really put me over the edge, is it does a better job remembering which triangles are disclosed in list view.
Yeah.
It doesn't remember that the window is in list view. Sometimes it shows to me an icon view for some reason. Sometimes it puts a sidebar back on it. Yeah. But when I change back into list view, I'm usually pleasantly surprised that the disclosure triangles are retained. Because like I look at my Dropbox that way, for example. A Dropbox is in a certain position on the screen. It's list view. It's got certain things disclosed, whatever I'm working on.
See, yeah. 15 years, a little bit of progress. There's hope.
No, that just, it's not progress. That just never went away entirely.
Yeah, okay.
Unlike you said, icon view, which is just, you know, even icons on the desktop, it's just.
You don't like icons?
No, icons on the desktop, like trying to grid align icons on the desktop. The names in OS X are so allergic to each other. If there is another file name anywhere near you and you try to, like, you know, command drag an icon to snap to the grid, it's like, I can't fit here. There's another name within 50 yards and it leaps to some other position on the screen. And so you have to clear this little space to make the icon feel comfortable so it will settle down into its grid position. Then you can move the other icons back.
Yeah, see, I don't use the grid either. I just have basically a mess.
You got to use the grid for, like, I bet you don't have volumes mounted on the desktop either, do you?
I do now, actually. What do I have? I got Jobo and my Time Machine stuff.
No, but do you show them on the desktop? I mean, it's not the default.
Yes, yeah, I do.
So I show them, and I want those to be grid aligned.
That is not a bad idea, because they do annoy me.
What you'll find out is the closest grid position is not near the edge of the screen, so you have to adjust the grid spacing and watch every other icon on your screen do this little dance. And then to try to, if you have a bunch of crap on your desktop, like I tend to when I'm working on things in big piles on the desktop like everybody else, they have to be super far away from those volume icons, because if you try to command drag one to snap to grid and there's anything remotely close to it on the left, that icon will just leap out of that spot and say, no, I can't go to this grid position. It's like, seriously, dude, your name is four characters long. Nothing is within 50 pixels of you. Just snap to grid.
That is, yeah. Okay. That's annoying.
No, I could have, it'll be like a 3-year project for me to get the Finder into basic functionality of like, resizing windows, aligning things in grid positions, like just things that are just not deemed important enough. It's like, well, does it crash? Does it make the file fly off so it's not findable anymore? No? Yeah. All right, it's fine.
What do you think about those iCloud file open and close dialogs? Like, you know, you get that grid.
Aren't those gone in Yosemite?
Are they?
Yeah, they replaced with iCloud Drive. Those are bad.
No, I'm looking at one right now.
What happened to you?
Text edit.
All right, so text edit Yosemite. I go open, right?
Yeah.
And
up at the top, it says iCloud. It says text edit - iCloud. Oh.
No, you're in the wrong OS, dude.
No, I'm not. I'm definitely in Yosemite, but I think this is because I upgraded. Because now when I... That's funny. So I went off of that one. It said text edit - iCloud. I selected iCloud Drive, which is directly below it. And then text edit - iCloud disappeared from the menu. So I don't know. There's some weird.
I've upgraded iCloud Drive. Maybe if you haven't upgraded iCloud Drive, you don't.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into this. But because I also came up through the betas and probably maybe screwed something up with text edit.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, though. It looked just like Springboard. And that was silly.
Yeah. So they backed out. Yeah. Cool, man. Anything else you want to get off your chest?
I don't know. What did we miss? What other grudges do I have? And your camp.
With me in particular, or just
I was nice and I didn't rub it in about Swift. Extensions.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I was entirely wrong, but
yeah, I heard you say that on the show. It's just ridiculous. Like it's not right or wrong. But like, here's the thing: you can still think that Apple didn't need to make Swift, but Apple did make Swift.
Yeah.
And so Apple did what I wanted, and Apple did not do what you wanted.
Okay. Well, right? I figured that way about the file name extension.
But I'm saying, but just because Apple did it doesn't mean you were right and I was wrong. It just happens I'm also right and you're wrong. But it's not, those are independent data points, right? But it is exciting for me, just as it was probably exciting for you to keep the world back in the Stone Ages by having file name extensions and everything. It's exciting for me that Apple did the thing that even I thought was a long shot for them to ever do, and did it in such a decisive way. New name, new language, new syntax, new everything. Like, you know,
me too.
Undeniable. So this show wasn't me coming on and us debating whether Objective-C 3.0 was really the new language I was looking for. Because like, whether or not I like Swift or not, it is just so clearly and whether it could fail too. Like whether it fails or succeeds, they did the thing that I thought they needed to do in their own weird way. No guarantee of success, you know, so on and so forth, blah, blah, blah. But
I totally agree. I expected a pragmatic approach.
I mean, this is pragmatic, but in a weird way. Like
exactly. Yeah. Like I didn't get what I expected. I didn't get what I thought might be what you were talking about, which is, a pearly ruby-ish kind of thing. We got something very different.
And more ambitious, I think. Even more ambitious.
I think so.
It was not even a... As I said in my review in the Swift section, possibly foolishly ambitious. Possibly that's the thing that brings it down. They tried to do too much, that to making a single language that spans this range is, you know, super hard. And like all they're doing is make their life more difficult and potentially causing the language not to be adopted. Like it's not low enough for low level guys. And the people who love dynamic dispatch and making selectors out of strings are pissed because it's not dynamic enough for them. And like that could very well be the case. And that I would say is not... wouldn't be a condemnation of my idea that they need a new memory safe language with modern, you know, features and everything. That mm-hmm. would just be like the way they chose to do it bit off even more than I was saying they should bite off, and then it didn't work out. But
you know, I agree.
We'll see.
I was thrilled when they announced it. So I'm, you know.
So all I've got left is the file system, right? And that one you agree with, John.
Yeah, The file system needs to change. I mean, I think they'll be more pragmatic.
But, at this point, what I mostly care about, like, it's weird because, like, now that they've bolted all this stuff onto Objective-C, like, all I care about is performance and data integrity, and I can't even decide which order though that I want this in. Probably data integrity first.
It's got to be data integrity.
But every time I see my machine thrashing because of disk, I just think single thread in the file system, one update to the catalog file at a time. Everyone get in line. I got 12 freaking cores, but one updater at a time.
But you've also got spinning disks.
So. No, I got an SSD now. It's exciting.
Oh, you do? Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's a secret. Don't tell anybody. But yeah, no, I splurged and got an SSD, and I'm dealing with, so the problem with having one SSD is that you still have to back it up to a spinning disk. And so just my SSD spends all the time twiddling its thumb going, are you done with that right yet? Because I got another one coming here. I'm doing the Time Machine backup now. It's been running for like 14 hours. It's got 200 gigs left.
Oh, that's brutal. But I mean, you did that because you didn't want the new Mac Pro and you don't want the Retina iMac, right?
Yeah, probably not. I'm going to try to extend the life of this machine. And like I said, it's not wasted money because whatever machine I get next, I'm pulling this thing out and, slapping it in a little case and it'll be a backup drive.
Yeah. 5K iMac looks great, but I don't think the GPU is going to have the juice to play games on it like you'd like.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's not even that. It's like, first of all, it's not a terrible GPU, but, someone sent me like an audio recording of what the machine sounds like while they're playing Portal on the iMac with a high-end GPU, and it's pretty noisy. Like, it's a compromised thermal environment as compared to the gigantic turbine fan in a Mac Pro, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, I think the Mac Pro could play Portal for a couple of hours without breaking much of a sweat and without...
Oh, yeah, I do it all the time. Play Arkham. I've had Arkham City and Origins, not the other one, Asylum, running at the same time on my Mac Pro. And
it doesn't sound like a hairdryer, right?
No, it doesn't.
Like,
no.
speeds up, but it doesn't sound like a hairdryer. And whereas like the iMac, it's not, it's desktop slash laptop, but it's in a super skinny case and there's little slit on the top and some air intakes, and it's just not same thermal environment. It's a gigantic tube with a huge gaping opening. So
you may be in a bad spot then.
What I'm probably going to do is just going to wait. You know, that's what the SSD will give life to this 2008 Mac Pro.
But what are you going to wait for? Like the next gen Mac Pro with?
Maybe the next gen iMac, maybe the next gen Mac Pro if like Thunderbolt 3 is around. Like, I mean, I feel like I'll probably use this for another year and then end up getting a second gen Broadwell iMac with a better GPU.
That's kind of what I'm planning on doing.
It seems
I'm keeping my Mac Pro because it's an amazing machine. It just can't do Retina, which I'm kind of sad about.
Yeah, so like I'll go another year non-Retina, and then at the end of it, I'll probably get the next-gen iMac, because I can't imagine the next-gen Mac Pro being ready in time just because of the lag on all the server parts and everything. So,
yeah, exactly. Oh, well, sad days. But good news, new SSD, so that's awesome. So, John, where do we find you? Well, first of all, everybody go buy the book.
That's too late for that now. Too late.
Is it?
You can still buy it.
Just go buy it to support Debug.
I bought them. I bought both.
Yeah.
I always do that. Like, so I have like the scratch copies of all my books on all my devices. And then at a certain point, I say, you know what? I think it's done. Typos are fixed. Not going to fix anything else. I will fix stuff. I always do. But I feel like this is done. And then what I finally do is delete all the scratch copies. Then I go to each of the stores and I buy the book for myself.
A little congratulatory present.
Yes, and I get the official version on my device. This is confusing if you have the real version and then you're constantly syncing it from your device or whatever. But yes.
It's like using your own frameworks. You're buying your own book.
Well, man, I use my own app all the time and it confuses the crap out of me. Anyway, yeah, that's annoying. So iBooks and what's the other one? Amazon?
Well, if you go to hypercritical.co, my blog that I never update, the top post there, and probably the top post there for a long time because I never update it, is an explanation of my review, which includes links to all the different versions, information about them, if you want to read the review or buy it in any form, or you have questions about the various forms that you can buy it in, all that information is there. So I'd say go to hypercritical.co.
Perfect. See, we're going to get you that spike, that server spike.
Yeah.
We're going to really move the needle there. And you're on ATP. Which you've been emails. Yeah. Perfect.
And that's Syracusa on Twitter.
Yep.
Cool. Thanks, man. Really appreciate that. And this went better than the last time.
It's about the same.